Welcome to the BIY Pod, a people podcast for the music business, bringing you meaningful and motivating career conversations. I'm Sylvia Gargiulo, the founder of BIY People and Talent, the people consultancy for the music business. In each episode, we'll share with you lovely listeners real career stories from some of the most interesting, inspiring and insightful people I've met over the course of my career. Our guest today is the total legend that is Simon Gough, CEO of Brownswood Music and Worldwide FM and director of We Out Here Festival. Having spent over 30 years working in music, spanning management, records, promotion, publishing, radio and live, Simon truly has an incredible wealth of knowledge and experience, not to mention some brilliant stories, some of which I'm lucky enough to have heard firsthand. I'm utterly thrilled that Simon has agreed to chat with us today to share some of that amazing insight and experience with us. Simon Gough, welcome to the BIY Pod.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here, of course.
Oh, thanks for joining us. I'm excited about this. And we're going to start off, as always, with our quick fire questions. So we're going to warm you up with those. Are you ready?
Yeah, this is a bit scary, this bit. I'm not quite sure what to expect. But yeah, go on, go for it.
It's all music related, Simon. You're going to be fine. Okay, we're going to go. What's the first album that you bought?
The first album I ever bought, I think, was Paranoid by Black Sabbath.
Love it. And what was the first gig you went to?
Oh, blimey. The first gig I went to. I mean, we're talking a very long time ago here, Sylvia. I think it was at a Roundhouse, which was in a sort of prior incantation to what it is now, but it was a gig venue in the 70s. I think it might have been Rory Gallagher or somebody like that, but I can't be 100% sure. It was a long, long time ago.
That's great. We'll take that. We'll take that, Simon. What's the last show you went to?
Well, last week I went to see Yusuf Days at Royal Albert Hall, which was a brilliant gig. He's obviously one of our artists on Brownswood. So, but yeah, he's put a new album out, which is amazing. And the show was very special.
Brilliant. Fantastic. And what's on repeat for you at the moment? Is it another Brownswood artist?
On repeat, what am I listening to, you mean?
Yeah.
No, I would say, I mean, obviously, yeah. I mean, all the Brownswood artists, of course, I listen to constantly. But right now, I've just recently actually bought a Linton Kwesi Johnson album that I'm really into. I thought I had most of his albums, but I found another one that I didn't have, and I've been listening to that a lot lately. So, Linton Kwesi Johnson.
Brilliant. And who's the artist that changed your life?
The artist that changed my life, well, it's definitely Joe Strummer. I was a massive Clash fan in the late 70s. I was exactly the right age and living in London when punk hit. So I was about 19 and going to lots of gigs already. And then punk came along and it was like, wow, this is amazing. And got massively into The Clash, went to see them loads of times. And that's probably, it changed my life in the sense that obviously I got into punk, I got into The Clash particularly. It was heavily political. There was a big reggae influence, which is something that I got very into subsequently. And yeah, generally, definitely my biggest influence.
We might delve into that when we come on to your career story as well, because I remember you telling me that. I was lucky enough to have lunch with Simon a few months ago, and he went through basically a lot of what we're probably going to talk about today. And yeah, it was really exciting, and it all started with The Clash. So great, amazing. And who's on your dream lineup if you were putting on your own show? What would it be, past or present, dream lineup?
Blimey. I mean, you could go on forever, couldn't you? I would, well, I tell you who would definitely be on it. I remember one of my favourite, all-time favourite gigs, I know you didn't specifically ask me this, but was, I don't know if you remember the DMC, Disco Mix Club. They used to have, I can't remember what it was called, but every year they used to put an event on, and it got quite big, and that ended up at the Royal Albert Hall, talking about the Albert Hall. And I remember there was one year they had both James Brown and Public Enemy on the same lineup.
That was
an incredible show. So I definitely have those two, James Brown and Public Enemy. Obviously Bob Marley, that would be amazing. Marvin Gaye, Robert Johnson, got to have a bit of blues in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gregory Isaacs, Dennis Brown, obviously The Clash. I was a massive Two Tone fan after the sort of punk era. Yeah. So definitely The Specials. Massive Attack, did I say them already? Can't remember.
No.
I probably have Galliano, because they've made a bit of a comeback now, and they're brilliant live. Loyal Carner. My teenage daughters are massively into Loyal Carner, and at first it was a little bit like, oh god, here we go again, but I've gradually got quite into Loyal Carner myself, so yeah.
Amazing.
I think that would make a pretty good lineup.
I think pretty good is an understatement, Simon. Thank you very much. That was amazing. What a brilliant lineup. Thank you so much for that. So before we get stuck into your career story, when you kindly agreed to be on the show, I sent you a list of words to pick from, your P's in the pod. And the P's you picked were passion, persistence and peace, which I love that you picked peace actually particularly, because I don't think anyone's picked that before. What was it about those words that made you pick them?
Okay, this was quite difficult, which obviously was the intention. Thank you very much for that, Sylvia. Passion is an obvious one, I guess, because I think anybody in the music industry or any of the sort of creative arts needs to have passion. And I think what's driven me certainly for a lot of my career has been my passion for music and for being involved in the music industry. And that, I think, makes you go that one step further than perhaps you would otherwise. So passion and that sort of feeds into persistence as well, which clearly, you know, you do need to hustle a bit. You do need to be quite persistent when you've got a good idea, or if there's something that you really want to do, you've got to be a little bit determined and persistent to try and make it happen. And I think the peace P, I thought a lot about this one, and particularly relevant at the moment with what's going on in the Middle East, of course, but and in the world generally. But I do also feel on a personal level that if you want to be successful in the music industry, one of the key things I think is to have a peaceful life and a peaceful existence around you. And I think that's both in your personal life, having your sort of personal life together and not having it too all over the place, but also your work life. So working with, you know, a group of people that you get on with, that you think are good and you respect them and they respect you. And I just think peace is actually something that, I know it's a strange one, but I do think it's actually quite important if you want to be successful in any walk of life, that you're at peace with yourself. So I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, I agree 100% with all of that. It is a weird one, piece, because I think sometimes when people see it on the list, they're like, what's she getting at here? But I couldn't agree more. You need that peace within yourself, don't you? Because it can be hectic and it can be demanding to work in music specifically, but I suppose a lot of areas of life can be pretty hectic. So if you can find that peace in yourself and you do it bit by bit or piece by piece, spelt the other way, if you will, that might be by building a schedule that works for you or doing some things, building things into your practice that help you find that kind of space and thinking time. And just, you know, routine works for a lot of people as well. It does for me. If my routine is kind of upset, it can be quite frustrating for me, partly because I think I've got a bit of an ADHD brain. So I do like that routine to keep me kind of in check and on track. So, and I would agree 100% with peace. Passion is obvious and absolutely agreed. Pretty much everyone I think that's come on here has picked that word. You need that 100%. But the persistence bit, I think, is really crucial as well. You mentioned hustle and like if you have good ideas, like keep on with those ideas. That's so important. And I think what I would probably link back to that as well from a recruitment perspective is that so many people get rejected from interview processes. It's what happens. You know, you might have, you know, 100, 200, 300 candidates applying for a job. There's only one job. So Law of Averages says, you know, if you're applying for those roles, you're going to get told no a lot. But I think it is just that persistence element.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, it's self-confidence, isn't it? And, yeah, you know, that can be tough. But also, I think with persistence, it's really important to be doing your own thing and building something beyond. I mean, we get, as obviously you do, Sylvia, we get a lot of people applying for jobs and you read a lot of CVs, etc. And the ones that are most impressive are the people who are doing extra things, showing their passion and showing their persistence by having their own, you know, blog site or putting an event on every month or doing something that maybe isn't even making the money, but they're doing it because they love it and they want to do it and they want to get that experience. And that's impressive. And that is, you know, so important, I think, when you're looking for jobs, to be able to show that you are prepared to go that extra mile.
Yeah, 100%. Couldn't agree more. I think that's going the extra mile or going a step further, like you mentioned, it's really crucial and it does make all the difference. So amazing. Brilliant. Well, thank you. Three brilliant P's you've picked there. So I think we should crack on with your career story, if that's all right.
Oh, I thought we'd finish now.
No. Got a bit longer, Simon. A little bit longer.
Yeah, so, fair enough.
Tell us then when and how, I suppose, did you come to realise that you could actually work in music and maybe that the business side existed?
Oh, I think it was a long time before I realised that you could actually make a living out of it. So I, obviously, as I said, I was a music fan. I was going to lots of gigs, buying lots of records and just, you know, being around as a fan and totally unaware of the business, really. I think, like, as most people, you know, records just turn up in record shops, gigs just happen. You don't really even think about what goes on around it all. And then I went to, there was a thing in London, and this was in the punk era, so this was must have been 1978. There was a Rock Against Racism carnival in London, and it was a march from Trafalgar Square to Victoria Park in Hackney. And at the end, there was going to be a free concert. And guess who one of the bands were that was going to play at a free concert?
Is it The Clash?
It was The Clash, exactly. The Clash and Sham 69 and Steel Pulse. Great lineup, you know, everything I was into. So I was like, wow, got to go to this. And, you know, Rock Against Racism, that sounds really good. I'll go to Trafalgar Square and go on the march to Victoria Park, not really thinking how far it was or anything. And expecting to be, you know, one of sort of 200 people going to the park, you know. And I got to Trafalgar Square and it was absolutely rammed. There were 100,000 people on this march from Trafalgar Square to Victoria Park. There were bands playing on the back of trucks. There was people singing and blowing whistles and it was just like amazing fun. And you know, this is when I sort of realised that there was this sort of movement going on, which was obviously very much about a reaction to the National Front, who were quite strong in the UK at the time and particularly in London. And I've actually got my grandfather was black Jamaican and came over here in 1899 and so forth. So I'd always had that sort of influence. You know, my father was mixed race. And so I, you know, felt drawn towards that and wanted to support it, obviously, but it was perfect for me. I was the perfect audience for it. And so went on this demonstration. At the end of it, there was the concert with The Clash. There's a little bit of film of it, actually. There was a Clash film called Rude Boy, and there's a bit of the concert in that, which is amazing. Whenever I see it, I'm like, oh. And there was actually a film came out last year when there was a bit of it in as well. I can't remember what it was. But anyway, so it was Rock Against Racism. And then I was a van driver at the time, driving around London for a stationery company delivering to sort of stationers. And I got in touch with Rock Against Racism because it inspired me. And I contacted them and said, you know, I'm happy to help out, volunteer, do whatever. And they said, oh, we'll come up to the office and we'll have a chat. So I went up to their offices And they said, what do I do? And I said, I'm a van driver. And they said, oh, really? That's interesting. And they had a magazine called Temporary Hoarding, which was their sort of fanzine that they produced every month. And they needed somebody to take it round to bookshops and record stores around London. And because I had a van, you know, they said, would I mind taking some of these to places? And I was like, yeah, fine, no problem. I can do that while I'm doing my work. So that's how I first got involved. And then they said, after a few months, they said to me, and we're setting up local groups. Would you, you know, where do you live? Would you be interested in setting up a local group? And I was living at the time in Brockley in Southeast London. So I set up Southeast London Rock Against Racism. And we had an amazing group of young people who met every week to put on Rock Against Racism gigs. And we used to do them at the Albany Empire in Deptford, which is still there. And various other places, Goldsmiths College. We did a big gig once and, you know, a few places, obviously, around Southeast London. That's how I sort of first got involved in putting events on and realising everything that went on behind the scenes, you know, booking the PA system and the sound engineer and all the publicity, of course, and the security, because that was a big issue, because we were in an area where there was National Front influence. And, you know, there was always the threat that the National Front would come along and attack the event. So, yeah, that was my first introduction, really, to the music industry.
And that's that. I mean, I love that story for so many reasons that I don't have time to go into now. But there's a couple of things there that I think would be helpful to kind of just highlight as well. It's, you know, A, the fact that, you know, you went to this event and you thought to yourself, I want to get involved, and you put yourself forward, you got in touch, you were really proactive, another P word that's on the list, you were really proactive and you got in touch with them and you got a meeting with them and they asked you what you did and you told them that you were a van driver, and you probably thought at the time, well, being a van driver is, you know, no use to man or beast. It's not going to help me in the music industry. But actually, there was something there that you were doing that was helpful to them, you know, just being able to help them out with something. So I think sometimes when candidates are starting out, they don't always realise that, you know, there's a skill that they have, or there's something that they do, or there's some experience that they have that is actually of interest, because people forget that in music, it's not actually glitzy and glamorous. There's a very, very, very small proportion of it that's the glitz and the glamour. And the majority of it is, like, starting out, certainly, is very much about logistics and making things happen and supporting other people. So, yeah, just wanted to kind of highlight those couple of points, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then talk us through what happened after that to kind of where you are now. I appreciate I'm asking you for like a summary of over 30 years in the music business, Simon.
Yeah, more like 40 years, Sylvia.
Simon, 40
years. I know. Don't. You make me feel old. Well, I am old. So one of the people that was in my Rock Against Racism group when we were putting gigs on, because I'd left school when I was 16 without any qualifications, and I didn't get on at school, didn't really enjoy it. So it never occurred to me to have any sort of further education. And one of my friends in our local Rock Against Racism group, she got onto a course at South Bank Poly at the time, it's now South Bank Uni at the Elephant and Castle, and to doing a sociology degree. And she said to me, you know what, you should think about that. And I'm like, what do you mean? I haven't got any qualification. I've got no A levels or anything. I can't go and do a degree. She said, no, you could go in as a mature student. They'll take you just on an interview if you're over the age of 22 or whatever it was. If you do a good interview, you might get a place. By then, I was actually, it's a long story, but I was a milkman. I really wasn't enjoying it. I don't know if you've ever really thought about what life is like for a milkman, although not many people have them anymore. But
pretty hard.
Certainly when I did it, you started work at 4 o'clock in the morning. There'd be days when it would rain all day and you'd just get completely soaked. And it was miserable. It was a miserable job. And so I was desperate to get out of doing that. So I applied for this this sociology degree at Southbank Poly, went along, told them I was putting on these Rock Against Racism gigs, told them the story I just told you, and they were like, oh yeah, great, yeah, yeah, you're exactly the sort of person we want on this course. And I'm like, really? I didn't even know what sociology was, really. I just, you know, but when they explained it to me, I thought, well, it sounded really interesting. It's about the world, and it's about politics, and it's about history and everything. So I was like, yeah, great, okay. And so I went and did a degree, and doing that, whilst doing that degree, obviously I got involved in the music side, the social side of the student union. I helped out with putting gigs on, started doing a bit of DJing because I had lots of records. And so when I left uni, I actually got a job for the local council in the housing department and just carried on doing DJing. Lots of people would ask me to DJ at their parties because I had the records. And then it got to a point where I was like, I'm really enjoying this. I want to do this more. How can I actually DJ in a club, do proper DJing? And the only way that I could see that that would ever happen was for me to put on my own club night. So I went to the Albany Empire in Deptford, which is where I've been putting on Rock Against Racism gigs. So I knew them. And I said to them, I want to put on a club night. I'm really into, by then I was really into sort of soul and reggae. And this is sort of 82, I think, around about 82. And I was like, you know, this was in Deptford, and there's nothing for the local community. The Albany was a great community theatre that put stuff on theatre stuff and alternative comedy and stuff. And there was a joke locally that everybody that went to the Albany lived in Blackheath, i.e. were really middle class, and there was really nothing for the local people in Deptford. And so I said, you know, why don't you let me run a club night for that will attract local people that have got nothing going on around here. And they were quite into that idea. So every Saturday night we had a club night called Soul Splash. And I used to DJ to start with, and then I'd book, you know, established named DJs to headline. And and after about 6 months, one of them said to me, you know, look, most of them were on pirate radio scene at that time in London was really big because there was no legal radio for this sort of music. And one of them said to me, do you want to come and join our pirate radio station? We're looking for DJs. And I was like, really? Oh, of course. And I started off doing 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. in the middle of the night. And I was told I wasn't allowed to speak, just play music. But yeah, I was on pirate radio, which was amazing for me. And I gradually worked my way up into having better shows on the pirate station. It was a station called Horizon. And because I was, you know, quite good at promoting myself, pushing myself and hustling, I started getting more gigs because I was going to other promoters going, hey, I'm on Horizon Radio, even though I was on the middle of the night. And I'd get gigs there, and then I'd go back to Horizon and go, well, I can, you know, get some advertising from these places because they're, you know, clubs that I'm playing at. So I then developed by becoming a DJ.
And those, I mean, on Horizon Radio, your pirate radio station, maybe they weren't the greatest hours, but you were used to it from your milk rounds, presumably.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah,
that's all right. Don't worry. And then, how did you go to the next stage? Because obviously, you know what you do now. You've been involved in, or you were involved in, artist management for many years, and you've got a record label. You've got Brownswood. Like, tell us how you went from, if that was your sort of step into it, the DJing side of things. How did you then kind of create the next stage of your career?
Well, the DJing got successful for me, and it got to the point where I was still working during the day. I was on the radio. By then I was on in the evenings on Horizon, and I was on the radio when it was on, because it wasn't always on because pirates were getting busted. But I'd be on the radio in the evening, and quite often I'd be doing club gigs. Well, I'd be doing club gigs every weekend. So I was really tired and running around like crazy, and it got to the point where I just felt like I had to give up my day job, which I wasn't enjoying anyway. And you know, that was a massive decision, and I'm sure it is for everyone and that in that sort of situation. But again, I think it's about self-confidence, and it's about having the belief that, you know, you can make this work. And I had enough going on that I felt confident enough about what I was doing. So I gave up my day job and developed my DJ career as much as I could. But then I'd find I'd get a bit bored, sort of, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, daytimes, you know, I wouldn't have anything to do because I've become a DJ and I was on pirate radio, and I'd go hang out at record shops and everything. But, you know, it was a little bit boring. I thought, OK, well, I wouldn't mind doing something else. Basically got a column in a magazine which at the time in London called City Limits, which was a sort of like Time Out. I think I just contacted them and said, look, no one's writing about this music scene and these records. And so anyway, they gave me a column every week or month, I can't remember, reviewing new release, import new release records on this sort of scene. And from there, I then, again, hustled. It got to write for Black Echoes, Blues and Soul, which were magazines that were around at the time on the scene. Then I met a guy called Paolo Hewitt, who asked me to come and write for the NME. So I was a freelance journalist for the NME. I did a bit for ID magazine as well. This is all in the 80s, so a long time ago. And all of this while I was DJing. And then eventually I set up my own promotions company. So I got approached by somebody at a record label because I was on all their mailing lists and used to contact them and go, oh my God, I hear there's a new Loose Ends track out. I really need it. Can you send me the promo? That sort of thing. And he said to me, oh, he was a guy working for MCA Records, which was a record label. It's basically part of Universal now, but there used to be a label called MCA. And their American label was very involved in the early hip hop scene in the 80s. So they were told by their American label, you know, you need to release some of these hip hop records in the UK. And they didn't have a clue. So they came to me and said, look, we need somebody to promote these records to DJs. And you're on that scene. Will you come in and just work, you know, one day a week or whatever, and send out, you know, work out, basically build us a mailing list of DJs that would play these hip hop records. So I did that for MCA and I thought, well, this is easy. You know, I've just created a mailing list here. I'll start my own promotions company and go to other record labels and get works. And that's what I did. So I ran a company called Secret Promotions for a few years. All this time, I'm still DJing and running club nights, and eventually set up my own little record label. I never even put an album out. I just did a series of 12-inch singles, I think about six of them at the time. I didn't really know what I was doing, but, you know.
But Simon, that no one does, and this is one of the things actually that I think is really interesting in terms of the story that you've told us so far. You were consistently using your passion for, you know, various different genres of music and music in general. You were using that hustle, that persistence to kind of keep on doing new things and trying new things. And you were, like, obviously super proactive in doing those things. And you built a reputation for yourself and you built a network. It's something we talk about all the time when we're talking about building a career in music and having a successful career in music. It's about a network as well. Well, you were putting yourself out there and making yourself known, you know, hence Paolo Hewitt saying, come and write for the NME, you know. So I think that's really, really interesting. And I think, you know, just picking up on that last point, you were like, didn't really know what I was doing. And I think that's, no one does know what they're doing starting out. And I think that's one of the things that I try to remind everyone who's starting out in their career or trying something new. You're not a finished article when you start. The biggest thing is actually doing the thing, like do the thing, give it a go, make some mistakes and you'll learn, or hopefully you'll learn, that's the plan. And if you're learning, then it's not a mistake, it's a lesson. So yeah, just wanted to jump in on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really important. Yeah, and I think it's also about being a little bit naive and not having any fear and just thinking, oh, I'll just give it a go and just, you know, try and make things happen. And I think sometimes people get too bogged down in like, well, what are people going to think of me, or you know, maybe this isn't the way to do things. Sometimes you just got to do it, not worry about it.
Yeah. Otherwise, what's the alternative? It just doesn't happen and nothing changes.
So, exactly.
Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted.
So then I got poached, I suppose, was the right word, by a record label. So I was doing some promotions for a record label, which was a sort of dance music offshoot of Fiction, who were associated with Polydor, who were, again, part of what is now Universal. And they asked me to come and do some A&R for this fledgling dance label they set up. They signed a couple of sort of Chicago house artists and asked me to go and work there. So I did. And the first time I ever went to America, actually, was when I went to work there. And they said, OK, you've got to go and meet our artists over in Chicago. And I was like, oh, yeah, great. OK, great. And I flew over to Chicago and went deep south side in Chicago to meet these house artists. And that was my first introduction to America. But by that time, I had met some guys when I was doing pirate radio. Actually, I was going in and making some adverts at a local studio. It was just a base at home bedroom studio near where I lived in Broccoli. And the guys that ran this place said to me one day, we're looking for a manager. Would you be up for managing us? Because we've got a few people contacting us about some mixes we've done and stuff. And I'm like, what do you mean? I don't know anything about management. And they were like, well, you're the only person we know in the industry. And I was like, well, I'm not really in the industry. I'm just a DJ. But I suppose to them, I was obviously in the industry. And so anyway, I started managing them. And they were called Double Trouble. And when I got offered this job, this A&R job, with this dance label, I brought them with me. Basically, I signed them to the label, and I was sort of managing them, and I was the A&R guy. And the first single went to number 11 in the charts, and the second single went to number 3. This was in 1989, I think. The track was called Street Tough. You won't remember it, Sylvia, but.
I wish I could say I did, Simon, but it did pass me by.
Yes, well, understandable. You were probably...
I was about 9.
Okay, well, you know. And so I was like, wow, this is great. This is really easy, isn't it? I think I'll do management full time. So I left the record label and set up my management company to manage Double Trouble. And they had a vocalist called Rebel MC. So Double Trouble and Rebel MC. And... and they subsequently went their own ways, and I ended up managing both Double Trouble and Rebel MC. And that was the start of my management company. And I had this management company for about 15 years. And then I got, see, a lot of these things just come along. I mean, you're completely right what you say about persistence and you've got to, you know, make things happen in the early days. But once you get to a certain level, then of course, you know, you start meeting new people, being in new situations, new things happen and new opportunities come along. Mm. So I was approached by Universal Publishing to become an A&R, senior A&R manager at Universal Publishing. And I was like, you know, why do you want me? I've got my own management company. And they were like, well, we need somebody that understands the dance music world and, you know, we think you'd be really good and blah, blah, blah. And they offered me a, you know, regular salary and a company car and an expense account. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is great. But I just started managing a drum and bass guy from Bristol called Ronnie Size. And
Ronnie Size, I do remember.
You do
obviously.
Remember, good. Okay,
of course
good.
I remember Ronnie Size. Amazing.
And but he hadn't put a record out. I mean, he'd put a couple of records out on his own little label, but he hadn't signed to a major or anything. And so I said to them, oh, I'll come and work for you as long as I can manage Ronnie Size on the side. And they were like, oh, yeah, fine. Some little drum and bass guy. That won't take up too much time. And so anyway, signed him to Talking Loud, where I reconnected with Giles Peterson, who's now my business partner. And, you know, that he won the Mercury Music Prize, that all went off. And I'm still working at Universal and managing Ronnie. And I'm, you know, I'm with him in Japan, I'm with him in America and everything. I'm phoning up going, oh, sorry, I can't make the A&R meeting this week because, you know, I'm in Tokyo or somewhere. So in the end, I had to leave. I mean, to be honest, working at a major wasn't for me. I was so used to doing my own thing and being my own boss that I found it quite difficult anyway, being in that structure. And so I don't think I would have stayed there anyway. But it was great to be able to then walk back into management with a successful artist. So I'd known Giles since our DJ days and Pirate Radio in the 80s. And then obviously with Ronnie Size on Talking Loud, which was Giles's label in the 90s. Giles had left Talking Loud when he got into Radio 1 as a DJ. And I managed Ronnie Size for 10 years, but eventually that came to an end. And so Giles and I just had a drink one night in a pub and he said to me, would you be interested in setting up a record label with me? And I was like, oh, maybe. And then I thought, well, you know, if you're going to do it with anyone, you might as well do it with Giles Peterson.
Absolutely.
His whole thing was, you know, he's still got access to lots of great music and a lot of it's not getting signed. And, you know, there's great artists out there who need labels. So we set up Brownswood Recordings in 2016 with Emily Moxon, who was already working with me on the management side. And she obviously came with me. And it's now the three of us are partners in Brownswood. Yeah, that's we've been running that for 17 years now as an independent label. And it's tough. It hasn't been easy. There's been times when, you know, it's been really tight. We haven't been able to take any money from the label. We've had to, you know, find other ways to survive. And we times when you thought you've had to close it down. But we've always managed to sort of hang in there. Again, going back to persistence, you know, you do have to be really persistent in all areas in this industry. Yeah, now it feels like the last five or six years has been this whole UK jazz explosion, which we're quite in the middle of, has been great for us. Then we set up Worldwide FM, an online radio station, about 6 years ago, and a UK festival called We Out Here. We've just had our fourth one. Obviously missed one in lockdown, but so it's been going for 5 years. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at now.
Love it, amazing. And a little correction there. I think you said you set up Brownswood in 2016, but I think it's, was it 2006?
Oh, sorry, yes, 2006. Yeah.
We're losing a decade. But yeah. No, one of the things I wanted to say, you mentioned about, you know, working for a major wasn't necessarily for you in that story. And you also said that, you know, in an indie, it can be really tough when you're either working for an indie or running an indie. You know, you've not always got the resources that a major has. So it's sort of engaging that passion and pushing on through and the persistence that we spoke about earlier. And there's an element of belief as well, isn't there, that you've mentioned, self-belief, you know, that, and that's part of, I suppose, the peace part of it. I think it can be tough having worked with, like yourself, having worked with majors and independent labels. They're two quite different worlds, you know. It's about, yeah. Obviously both are about making records, but they're two very different experiences. And some people work really well at majors but wouldn't, you know, don't enjoy an experience at an indie, and vice versa. So I guess for anyone thinking about working for a record label or building their career within, you know, the label world, try both, you know, and one of them might not be for you. You might be one of those people that enjoy both equally, but I think they are very, very different experiences often. And I think if you're gonna work for an indie, it can be amazingly rewarding, but it's not always easy, particularly in terms of budgets and resources and that kind of stuff. Not saying it's easy within a major, but
yeah. And I think there's two types of personality in many ways. You know, some people just want a secure, settled job and a paycheck at the end of the month and know that they're okay and they can pay their bills, etc., etc. And other people are more inclined to want, you know, what I guess is the perhaps the excitement or the thrill of not knowing if where this is all going. And you know, you could make a lot of money, you could go completely bust. And I think that's, I'm just one of those sort of people that, you know, just can't really take that, you know, working for a big corporation, and that's just not my personality. And I much more enjoy being self-sufficient, being in control, even if I'm not earning the sort of money that I could elsewhere. I mean, let's face it, if we all wanted to earn lots of money, we should become accountants or lawyers or something. Yeah. You know, you're in the wrong industry. Yeah, exactly. It's where you really wouldn't go into the music industry. You do it because you love it, and that's what you want to do. And I think, for me, I've always thought the happiest people are the people that enjoy their job, because we all spend half our lives at least working. And so if you really love what you're doing at work, then you're going to be happy in your life, but hopefully. So it's really important that I enjoy my work life, and I enjoy it much more if I'm in control of it.
For myself, running my own business, obviously there was some point in my career where I think anyone who knows me will attest to the fact that I hate being told what to do. I'm the worst person to try and tell me anything. I'm not gonna listen. And it was almost inevitable that I would set up my own business. And, you know, I guess what the trade-off is, you step away from a big company and you step away from a decent salary and potential growth in earnings that's going to increase year on year, and you set up your own thing. And, you know, sometimes you're going to make a lot of money, or sometimes you're in my boat, you don't make a huge amount of money, but I love what I do. So I make that mean that I'm a really lucky person, because I don't think anyone could, and particularly for music, you're going to be working long hours. You know, you've got to love it, because if you don't, it's just, there's hundreds of other people around you that are going to invest more time, effort, energy into projects, and that passion really does make a difference. So to the outcome of all the projects you work on as well, you know, if you're half-assed about something, you can't expect it to really succeed. So
yeah, exactly.
Amazing. Thank you for taking us through your career story. That is incredible. And like I said earlier, you know, we went for lunch earlier this year and you told me your story, and I was just like, I've got to ask Simon to be on the podcast. I love your story. You know, and there was a few things in there that you mentioned. You know, you left education early and you went out and you started working, and then you re-entered education at a later date. And I think sometimes people could benefit from that. You know, you don't have to come straight out of, you know, your school or sixth form or whatever it is and go straight into uni. You could go and do some work experience, like go and do a year's working and get your head around what you really want to do. And then if you do decide to go back into education, you can make a really informed choice about what you do, because it's really expensive to go to uni. Or you might find yourself on an apprenticeship, or you might find yourself, you know, in a career you love and you work your way up. There's lots of people who I know who came out of, or there's a handful of people that I know who came out of education, didn't go to uni, and, you know, are running their own businesses in music now. So it is possible. I suppose I'm one of those people thinking about
it. Exactly. And I think, I mean, I taught for a few years, one day a week on the BA Commercial Music degree at Westminster Uni, which I really enjoyed doing, and there were some really good people on it. But I do think those courses, which are great and they do teach you a lot, but they're not necessarily going to get you a job, and it doesn't really lead directly to, you know, not in the direct way that becoming a doctor would or whatever. So I think that, you know, it's much more really about your extracurricular activities, what your passion is, and how you go about, you know, making things happen for yourself.
Yeah, agreed. It's not just because you're studying that, it does not guarantee the job. I think it's about your character, your behaviours, your attributes. So you making the most. I you know, do lots of work with music unis, and there'll be candidates, or there'll be students who don't come to sessions that are put on specifically about finding a job in the music business. And then in 5 years' time, they're like, oh, I studied at this college. And you're like, oh, I do a lot of work there. I don't, you know, I don't remember your name. I don't remember meeting you. And it turns out they didn't come to those sessions. They didn't make the most of it. So it is very much about that. It's you're going to get out what you put in, and you're not always going to get it out at the same rate. Just because you work mega hard for a year, it doesn't mean that the next year is going to be all success. It will be a gradual build. But those things, you seed those things, you build on that, and it will all come to fruition eventually. Well, that's your career story. A couple more questions, I suppose. One that I always find quite interesting is what do you think the biggest challenge in your career that you've faced to date?
The biggest challenge in my career? I mean, just making a living, really. I think when you are working for yourself, you know, it's a constant battle to get the money in, to do things. And I think also in music, there's a tendency to end up doing things really cheaply or for nothing because you like the people or because they haven't got any money or you think they're talented. And, you know, you have to sometimes, you know, really think about the money and how it's going to come in. And there's been plenty of times in my life when, you know, I've there's been no money in the bank. I've got maxed out credit cards and I'm like, geez, I don't know where the next money's going to come from. But it's always spurred me on. It's always made me hustle even more and think, okay, I've really got to go out and earn some money here. And you know, it's not necessarily a nice feeling, but, you know, that's just the reality of it. I think that it can actually be quite creative in a way. So, just making a living, I'd say.
Yeah, and I think, look, on that point, you know, you can't do stuff for free all the time, and I suppose that it's important to know your worth and know your value. It will take time, and I think salaries and you know, pay rates are a big topic of conversation for music in general, particularly at the moment for people particularly living in London and cost of living, and you know, people are looking for higher salaries than ever before, and you know, ensuring that artists are being paid fairly for their work as well. Streaming's obviously changed how artists or where artists take their revenue from. So yeah, I guess money is a challenge, full stop, across the board. So yeah, interesting one. There's a lot to that conversation, I think.
Indeed.
And what do you wish you'd known when you started out?
What did I wish I'd known?
Yeah, is there anything where you look back now and you said, oh, if I could talk to, you know, 22-year-old Simon or 28?
No, not really. I mean, I think, going back to what I was saying earlier, I think being naive when you start out is probably a good thing. I think in some ways, not ignorance is bliss, that's silly, but you know, being not really knowing how hard it can be or the challenges involved, so you know you just do it because you want to do it, and I think that's quite nice. I think I never had a plan. I never had this, oh, I want to one day run my own record label, or I one day want to be a successful manager, or I one day want to be interviewed by Sylvia Gargiulo on BIY Pod. It was just...
You did, Simon. Don't pretend.
I did, really. But no, you know, I just did as things came along and opportunities presented themselves, and I tried to take advantage of them. But I think if I'd known too much when I started out, I don't think I'd have done as much as I have. So I actually think... perhaps it's better that I think that naivety actually helped me. So yeah, I think sometimes in this world, you know, with internet and everything and all the courses there are and everything, you know, we all know too much and it's too easy to find stuff out, and sometimes it's better to just do it and not to worry too much about it. But I don't know.
Yeah, it can be overwhelming. It can be overwhelming when you're getting so much information. Like, there's the good side and the bad side, isn't it? It's like, when I was a kid, if I needed to find something, if I had to find something out, I had to look in an encyclopedia or go to the library. The plus side now is that you do, you know, you want the answer to something, Google it. You've got loads of points of reference and information. But the negative side to that is it can just be really overwhelming. And people are like, well, what if I don't get this right or that right or the other right? And actually, I think the most important things, and you said it in a roundabout way, it's that energy and that hunger when you're starting out that will really drive you on. And, you know, just to make a start is the most important thing. And as you sort of displayed through your career story, when you were talking us through that, getting yourself out there, putting yourself out there, meeting people, be open to opportunities. The more you do that over the years, and as you get through your career, the opportunities come to you a bit more. You know, people think of you because they've seen you in that space, or they know you know these people, or you've done that thing. And all of a sudden, you're the person that people want to talk to. So, or not actually all of a sudden at all, but, you know, through a process of hard work and, you know, hard graft over the years, you get there eventually.
And I think it's just make shit happen. That's the most important thing, is just make it happen, whether it's putting an event on or writing something, or just, you know, just create something. Yeah. And, you know, the opportunities will come along.
Yeah, and if people won't give you the opportunity, create that opportunity for yourself. I think we can, you can do it. So exactly. Amazing. Finally, what would you like to change in the music business? Is there anything that you'd like to see changing?
Well, obviously, running an independent record label, I'd like to see it being more of a level playing field for independents generally. I think the music industry is largely controlled by a small amount of major labels. I think obviously there's a massive issue with diversity in the music industry, and that's something that is being tackled by some people, but it really needs to be continually tackled and tackled more. I think there's a lack of support for artists when they, for instance, when they lose their record deals, and stuff like that. People can fall apart, because you can go very quickly. You can be 19 years old and go from being, you know, at all the parties and having loads of money and having cars pick you up to take you for interviews, etc., to suddenly being, you know, redundant and you know, on the dole. So I think there's a real lack of support for artists, particularly in that sort of situation. So yeah, there's lots of challenges in the music industry that I think need to be addressed, and some of them are, and you know, I think all you can do is be part of that and try and improve things wherever you can.
Yeah, and it's what can you, you know, I think sometimes people get overwhelmed with the scale of an issue, but all you can really do is tackle it from your own sort of sphere of influence, if you like. That's what can I do directly around me to make those changes? And obviously, Simon, the way that you and I met was through the HR work that I did with you with Brownswood and Worldwide FM, and you were like super open to getting policies and processes in place that meant the playing field was leveled for people. So I think if everyone, and then ensuring obviously that not just the policy and the process is there, but we carry that out in our behaviours and actions and how we operate on a daily basis, how we move through the world, if you like. So that's your sphere of influence. What can I do to make sure that I'm part of the change that I want to see? Well, okay, well, these are actually some practical things that I can do. It's great, you know, great that people are talking about it, but that's just a load of hot air unless people are actually taking action to make those changes and put those changes into practice. So it was always a pleasure working with you guys at Brownswood and Worldwide FM.
Thank you, it's a pleasure working with you.
We get into a love fest there. Thank you, Simon, that's amazing. And I guess it's a good time to talk about the cause we care about. So each episode we'll be making a donation to a cause that we care about on behalf of our guests. So tell us who you've picked and why, Simon.
Okay, so I've picked Help Refugees, who run the sort of Choose Love charity, and I just think that the refugee crisis, particularly over the last few years, is one of the biggest challenges in the world. Particularly, obviously, what's been going on recently in the Middle East, but generally, anyway, what's been happening everywhere for the last few years is you know, obviously massively sad and massively important that. That this, you know, the world becomes a fairer place, if you like, and people have more opportunities. And I think they're an organisation that we've worked with a number of times with Worldwide FM. We do Refugee Week once a year. We do a bunch of radio shows around it, often with the support of Help Refugees. And I just think they're a really important charity who, you know, do really important work. So it's the one that I would choose.
Brilliant, brilliant choice, brilliant cause, brilliant charity. Thank you so much, Simon. That's amazing. And thank you so much for being a guest on the pod today. It's been, I'm so happy to be able to share your story that you shared with me over lunch in a fabulous Italian restaurant, because I think there's so many great points there that people can connect to, and hopefully that will inspire people to that they can do it, you know, whatever way they do it, it's possible to make it happen, and they can look at you as an example of where you can get to, which is super exciting. So thank you so much, Simon. I really
pleasure.
Appreciate
thanks.
Your time.
Thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Bye.
So that's it for another episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget to rate and review. If you like what you've heard, give us 5 stars. If you don't bother, obvs. Like, subscribe and follow the BIY pod. And you can follow us on our socials as well. We're at biy.people.and.talent on Instagram and BIY People and Talent on LinkedIn. If you've got any burning questions, you can email them to us at hello@biypeople.co.uk with BIY pod in the subject line. And finally, a big thank you to our superstar producer, Scarlett O'Malley, and the ever-patient Emma Newburn for logistics support. This podcast was brought to you by BIY People and Talent to help you believe it yourself, build it yourself, and be it yourself.